plaintiff have continued. These are being handled by the Attorney General's office. The only new development there is that an appraiser has been retained who has expertise in assessing the impact of noise damages. But that hasn't moved beyond the point of contracting with this individual. The other development since the previous reading, I'd indicated that in answer to a letter that we wrote to the FAA, they indicated that if the state proceeded with all state funds to build the project, it was doubtful that they would reimburse the state at a later date, even though we prevailed in the suit.
Thanks, fellas.
Mr. Gordon, on the permit.
Sorry, Mr. Sneeders, we unwittingly reported out the permanent fund bill rather than one we just considered. Please proceed.
Okay. We've had an indication from the FAA that if this bill were to pass and the state were to proceed with construction with all state funds, that it is probable that if we prevail in the suit, if the state and federal government are successful in defending themselves against the suit, that the FAA would later reimburse us for what would normally be their share of the cost. FAA is looking at amending the grant that we have to clarify that. We don't have anything in writing, but they are looking at it.
I thought you did have something right.
We got a letter from them initially that said, no, we will not reimburse you retroactively. Then we received an exchange of correspondence that occurred within FAA, which reflected a difference of opinion within the agency on whether they could or whether they could not. And at this stage of the game, it appears that the coulds are prevailing and that the amendment, that the existing grant will be amended to make that clear. But we don't have it yet.
Well, it was my understanding that there was a letter from FAA that committed themselves towards to this project, assuming the lawsuit was finally determined in favor of the government.
We have a letter from the chief of their program development section that says that that is possible under the terms of the act, which is in conflict with a memorandum to him from their general counsel. So that they're on record right now, there are two different opinions within FAA.
Is Commissioner Harris going to testify on this?
He had another bill that he had to testify on.
Is he coming back here?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman.
Is that in Senate finance?
No, I don't believe so. I think it was across the street.
Well, what is DOT's official position on this?
As I indicated in the last reading, we're in favor of the bill. You know, we're not eager to spend $30 million in state dollars if there's the possibility of getting federal. But passage of the bill would give us an option that we would like to have. We don't want to wait indefinitely for this runway to be built either. It's the number one priority project on the airport, and we'd like to see it move forward.
All right. Now, it's my understanding that the legal issues involved a determination on the part of, or at least an initial determination on the part of the judge from Los Angeles that that the FAA had not shown a necessity for the crosswind runway because their own regulations say that they won't finance a crosswind runway unless the wind is shown to be more than 15 knots at least 5% of the time. Is that correct?
You have to show that you have a 15 knot direct crosswind component 5% of the time.
Okay. And that apparently that was not shown by the federal government, course, I know the state was not a party to this litigation to start with, but apparently the federal government didn't show that. And what one set of lawyers says, there's no way we can lose. The other set of lawyers says, there's no way we can lose. And I've heard all that before. But I hope to have some way of finding out what kind of evidence people had. Is there evidence that the federal regulations as to federal funding of the Crosswind runway are met, or is it pretty much questionable?
Initially, the Crosswind computations were performed by our staff, that is the state. And we came up with 5.2% of the time we had a direct crosswind component to that existing runway in excess of 15 knots. Mr. Overby retained a meteorologist out of California, Mr. Kale, and based on his computations, he came up with 4.9% of the time that we had 15 knot direct crosswind component. There are different methodologies that you can use, and part of the difference was in the data that we considered and that he considered. There were 2 years when the anemometer was in a protected area, and the crosswinds during that 2 year period were down around 2%. And we threw out that data in our computations on the basis that it was not representative. He considered it. That accounts for some of the difference. Since the hearing, we retained a Mr. Haggard, who is former director of the National Weather Service. He's a well-known and highly regarded meteorologist. He has gone through all of the data, made a very detailed analysis of it, and he has come up with 5.2% crosswind coverage. We feel that our position with respect to crosswind coverage is very strong at this point.
I might add, so does Overby. I think his case is strong. All right. Is this case to be decided by a judge or by a jury?
Judge.
They didn't ask for a jury trial on the factual issue. Is there, the judge appears to be sympathetic with Mr. Overby, or he does by his previous actions anyhow. I don't know whether that indicates anything or not. Maybe he just wants to stop all, to hold the status quo until he makes a final decision. Are there other parties to the litigation besides Mr. Overby and the federal government and the state which has intervened, I understand?
No.
Just those three?
Those three.
All right. Is the state pursuing active efforts to settle with Mr. Overby?
Yes.
I don't think it's very likely that the case will be settled, but I've talked to Mr. Overby and doesn't sound like anything like that's going to happen. But it's a possibility that it will, I suppose. Incidentally, for the members of the committee, Mr. Overby was going to be here today. However, he had to be out of town. Suddenly had to go to Seattle for business reasons. So I think also. What about the other property owners? How many people are in substantially the same position as Mr. Overby as far as the law is concerned?
I believe there are
noise pollution, I suppose.
Yeah. Or, as I recall, there are about 150 homes that would be within the same noise contour.
Has the Department of Transportation or the Department of Law made any rough estimate as to how much it would cost to pay the owners of those 150 homes the diminution in value of their property?
Estimated cost, Mr. Chairman, is $12
million. $12
million? Yeah.
Where was that from, Mr. Swartz?
Well, that's taking the average home in that area at $80,000 a piece and there's 150 homes.
Well, you don't.
Well, when you settle with somebody, you settle.
More.
Right.
Where do those figures come from, Slice?
Off my paper.
Would the state would not in fact be required to repurchase those homes, is my understanding. In fact, I would suppose most of those residents would choose to stay there, but the state would in effect pay them the difference in the value of their home that was caused by the construction of the runway, the planes flying over there every day, I guess.
Most of the homes that are in a like noise environment are not in the approach to this runway. We're talking about an existing situation east of the airport that already exists. In other words, we've got homes there that have been exposed to noise levels equivalent or higher than we predict Mr. Overby will be. And these are the people that we're talking about generally.
Now wait a minute, these are people that are already exposed to the noise?
That's right.
What's that got to do with the crosswind runway?
It relates to it in that if the state adopts a policy of recognizing noise damages in the south approach to a north-south runway, it's difficult to see how that would not also then relate to an equivalent level of noise exposure in the east approach to the east-west runways. I don't think you could make a distinction between the two.
Well, I can make one right on right in my head. I think it's one thing to say that the state can recognize it, but matter of fact, there's either a legal obligation to pay or there isn't. I don't think it involves the state recognizing the thing one way or the other.
I think, Mr. Chairman, one of the difficulties in noise suits is that it's such a subjective issue. We've used all of the current methodologies that are available to try to predict what the impact of the noise is going to be on people, but neighbors will disagree on whether or not they've been damaged. And airport operators typically assume a defensive posture. If people can come forward and demonstrate that they have been damaged, operators deal with them, but to go out and say everybody within this area, you know, has been damaged, or we have, you know, damaged their property or the useful enjoyment of it, you can't very well do that in on a noise issue, because many of those people may feel that they're not hurt at all.
Well, let me put all this another way, okay? Where is Overby in relation to the, with respect to where the north-south runway is supposed to go? Where is he?
No, he's about...
What I'd like to... Can you write on that thing back there, or is that a bulletin board? Anybody?
How about that?
I don't know. I've got a print.
How about the bottom of the print somewhere there?
See if I got it. I can take those off.
Let's all go to Anchorage and take a look at this.
Yeah, go to right on the plane, that we'd have to fly in and fly over. Grab your crosswind.
Both will out posthumously.
All right, let's do it over here. I don't think we'll have any
loyal
ones. I hate to remove the flame of the art.
Get out your alcohol take out of it.
Here, better you look at it.
Is that gonna show up? I would suggest we got it. Just to hopefully get you oriented, north is to the top, this is west, of course, Fire Island is out here. Terminal area, this is Nick Arm. Present time, we have two east-west parallel runways, these are the primary instrument runways that are used by the large jet transports. The north-south runway that was proposed would lie in here about like so. Tenino Hills is directly in line with the extended center line of that runway.
How far away is it?
It's about a mile. It's approximately 5,000 feet, or 5,000 feet from the south threshold to Mr. Overby's house.
What's the altitude of the airplanes that would be approaching right over their house or taking off? What's the rate of climb? How far would it be over their house?
Typically, on a departure, they would only use this runway in this direction when there's a high wind condition. So it will vary depending upon the aircraft. But let's say something like a 707 DC-10, I would say typically would be perhaps 1,000 feet by the time they get over the Overby property on a departure and direction. They would be at a lower altitude on an approach, but that's a reduced power setting, so typically it isn't as noisy.
How many days in it?
We expect the high wind condition to exist on the average of about 2 days per month.
Is that 5% of the time?
Mr. Chair? Pardon?
That would have to come with this, and that's 5% of the time?
That's something less than 5%, approximately.
So,
Russ?
So his circumstance wouldn't change at all except for those 2 days a month when he gets things that way, because he's getting them out of the other way, right? I mean, if he's hearing anything at all, it's not going to change if they go the other way, so.
That's right. The predominant traffic flow when this runway exists, right now we have a short north-south, but it's not long enough to accommodate any large aircraft. So the predominant traffic flow is landing to the east and departures to the east. And of course, you have a large concentration of residential area out in this part of town. And that's the area that's impacted. And that's the relationship I was talking about earlier. But there are already people here that are probably exposed to 20 times the numbers of operations that Mr. Overby will be.
Okay, I'm talking about Overby's section right in there. Now, how many people are we talking about there? My understanding was eight.
That's right. I think there are eight residences. There are two additional residences that were put under construction this year in this subdivision. There are a couple of other isolated homes in this general area. And as you get out here next to the bluff line, this is Turnigan Arm. There are more homes out here. The area in between is primarily gravel bits and undeveloped, even though it's zoned residential.
Mr. Swanson?
Yeah, where was the 150 homes that you referred to?
They're in this area.
Well,
they're the ones that are affected by the east-west runway. Yeah.
Now, if you said that the state was in negotiations with Overby now, or talking about it, if they settle with him, then in the circle for the people on the runway going the other way, those were the people we talked about that would be the same, affected the same 150.
They're in the same noise
content. All right, they'd be the same noise content. Well, then we'd be subject probably to suits there too.
That's our concern.
Yeah, okay. That was where I just took the average cost per home. But I guess Weatherby's home is worth more than $80,000.
Yes.
Well, it looks to me like the state doesn't have any choice but to litigate. How else can you determine what people's rights are? I don't know the words, what, you can settle with Overby, I guess, and then you can get the money, but it looks like all those other people are gonna come running in as soon as they...
That's right.
I don't know.
So isn't it a difference, Overby's filed suit, as opposed to going out and settling with somebody who hasn't filed yet? There might be a difference there, but you're not admitting that he's got any noise pollution or any problems potentially. You're trying to release a contested claim. I don't know that that's, of course it isn't evidence in any further litigation, but I don't think it's... Of course, it may spur the owners on in the east-west end of it to do it. I don't think it sets any, it's no legal evidence or proof of any kind of claim.
I think that's right, but that's a legal question, so I'm out of my element in talking about it, but there are some other, you know, considerations that enter into this. These people have been exposed to this over a period of time, so, and the result of the north-south runway is a betterment in their circumstance. You know, the amount of noise exposure that they will receive once this north-south runway is built will be an improvement. They will get relief. So that would tend to work against suits emanating from this area. This particular subdivision is a very exclusive subdivision, and I think that probably makes a difference as far as damages are concerned. The people who can afford to live here probably don't have to put up with some of the things that people in less expensive residential areas might. There might be more of a, you know, a decrease in value because of the type of area that this is. That's a consideration. But we've been very hesitant to go out and try to draw a line and say, this area is noise impacted, and we will agree to pay damages anywhere within this area. Because noise being like it is, an individual on the opposite side of the line can argue very effectively that he has as much noise as the fellow who is within the area that you've described as noise impacted. It's very difficult to keep something like that under control. And the ongoing studies, even though we may come up with a noise contour, and we say that all these contours do is attempt to predict how people will react to noise within that area. And generally, perhaps only 25 or 30% of the people within that contour may be adversely impacted by it. There are just some individuals who can't tolerate it. The tolerance level of aircraft noise and overflights differs widely with different people.
Probably depends a lot on you know, what hours are there too.
That's right. If they're on the back side of a hill, if you have a lot of vegetation on your property, spend a lot of time outdoors, windows open, all of those things make a big difference.
Russ?
Seems to me that, you know, even if you could settle out of court with Overby, I mean, there's another question. There's other questions besides the legal question. It seems to me that it would really be unfair to, you know, because Overby's in a position to litigate and he's only getting 5%. He's only getting this noise 5% of the time. There's people that have been experiencing that for years and years, and a lot more people. It seems to me to be really unfair to sort of pay him off and then fight the other people. I mean, legally, you know, maybe you could do it, but it just seems like if you're going to adopt a policy of paying people for the noise pollution, then you should pay everybody, particularly those people that are getting it 15 times more than he is. And they're the ones that are really suffering. So I would think that it, I mean, my opinion is, regardless of what the legal questions are and whether you can do it or not, it's just not right to bargain with Overby. I think you ought to litigate, and if those people have rights, then they all have rights, and if they don't, then they don't. And I think that's what should be sought after.
Clark? So one difference, of course, is that a lot of those people on the end of the east-west runway built after the runway was there, didn't it?
Yeah. That's true.
should make a difference.
It will be built after the plans with Marcel and Waverly.
Eli, yes, and we'll take care of it.
There's one question I've got. FAA funding for runways, is that funding also available to compensate people for damage that might occur to their property because of construction of the runway? Or does the state have, it is available for that? Would it be available retroactively for those people in the path of the east-west runway?
I'm not certain.
Okay.
It's a possibility.
Is it based on a fixed sum? In other words, would it be, would the FAA really come in and participate in this, or do you just get an overall sum and you spend it any way you want it?
No, I think you'd have to determine damages on an individual basis.
I'm talking about the state, how much money the state is entitled to. Is it a fixed sum, or is it very important to the needs?
It's for the most part, it's a fixed sum. The bulk of the money that we get under the federal grant program is distributed by formula based on passenger enplanements, population, that type of thing. There is a smaller amount of money that's distributed at the discretion of the FAA administrator, and that amount can vary from year to year, but that's a relatively small part of the total federal grant program.
Okay, so what you're saying is, I think, so we might get, I don't know, 30, whatever, what is it?
About 30 million years.
About $30 million there. But that would be all you get, regardless of what you use it for. You could use it to buy up Overby's rights and those eight people there if you wanted to, but if you didn't do that, you'd get the same amount of money anyhow.
That's right.
Okay, so we're really talking about paying state bucks, I believe, for Overby's claim. As a practical matter, because you'd use all the money anyhow.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me ask.
Ernie?
Are you talking about FAP money now?
Yes.
So, in other words, you'd put all that money in there, and all the rest of the airports in the state would have to sit back and wait till it took care of that, huh? Is that about the way it looks?
North-South Runway. The funding that we proposed would be spread over about 3 or 4 fiscal years. So the impact of the project is spread over that period of time.
Better to build a new airport.
What is, that was going to be the next question I had. What is it? We keep hearing up here rumors of this super airport over there in the Metsu someplace over in the valley. What if anything is DOT doing with that? Is there some plan in the future that a super airport be established over there and Anchorage International be phased out into a general aviation place?
That was one of the alternatives that was considered at some length in the environmental impact assessment for the North-South Runway, because there was an issue that was raised. The state has reserved property generally west of Goose Bay, for those of you who are familiar with it. It's about, 15, 20 miles north of Anchorage International. The cost of developing a new international airport to accommodate the large jet type traffic that we have here, I think was estimated at close to $300 to $400 million to duplicate this facility. And that just, doesn't appear to be the practical thing to do. We just, we intend to keep our options open and hang on to a piece of land that would accommodate that class of airport over there, at least until a higher and better use for that property develops. But at least within the foreseeable future, this would appear to be the best airport. This is a very unique airport site, and as major airports go, it's difficult to find one that is any better. You've got water really on two sides of it, and relatively few residences on the south side, and you're immediately adjacent to the community that you're serving. It's a very good, a very unique airport site.
Can you see pressures developing to remove Merrill Field from the middle of Anchorage? Naturally, it's got to go someplace, so people are going to say, let's move the general aviation international, move Anchorage international. Do people see that kind of pressure developing, or how does it...
There's pressure to move Merrill Field, but there's a master planning study currently underway, and the one of the recommendations of that study will be to develop another parallel runway at Merrill Field to accommodate more traffic there. As far as moving general aviation here and the air carrier someplace else, the problem with that is that you've got a lot more facility here than general aviation can reasonably use. And you could take, for a relatively few $1 million, you could probably go across Nickarn and build a general aviation airport that would accommodate 400 or 500 based aircraft. But to duplicate this someplace else is...
You'd have to fly to get over there to get your plane.
That's right.
That's not true. That's right at the end of the tourniquet arm causeway. Let's face it.
Another
350 million.
We have a problem with Mr. Overby. I think as major runway projects go, if you look at the track record on any of them recently, Honolulu, Detroit, Miami, we're in reasonably good shape. We've got one individual at this point in time who is opposing it. With this runway system, we're projecting that probably 85 to 90% of all operations can be conducted over water, which is a good situation.
Right. Yeah, I see what you mean there. Russ?
Well, do they get winds going both ways? I mean, coming from the north and coming from the south?
Yes, in the wintertime, the prevailing winds are out of the north. In the summertime, the prevailing winds are out of the south, the southeast.
So in the summer, you'd be using north-south runway, but you'd be going north on heading
north. Well, the most critical operation, of course, is landing. And the pilots are primarily concerned with the tourniquet winds because of the turbulence. You have a lot of high, irregular terrain here along the bluff. And at the present time, their typical approach with the tourniquet wind is to the east, and they pick up wind shear and turbulence on short final between Fire Island and the point of touchdown. So that's the type of operation that, with the north-south runway, would simply land here. And historically, there have been a lot of operations on this shorter north-south, so we know what our turbulence situation is there, and it's very tolerable.
You'd be dead calm coming in there, and you get out around the turning an island, it's rougher and calmer.
When is it
okay,
Ms. Buckle.
I want to ask you if, because Anchorage is departure of the north, we don't have less traffic in the winter than in the summer. Isn't it continuous flow?
Pretty much so. It drops off some in the winter time, but not substantially.
So there would be every reason for north-south runway in the summer as well.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nugget,
certainly the overriding factor is safety, isn't it? It is absolutely unbelievable that you could that a situation like this could develop. I understand people's rights and all, but they certainly ought to take that into consideration when they're buying property there too. They're bucking the wind too, But all they got to do is pile up one of those jets with a load, and then what? Run the guy out to low tide and tie him up to a rock and let him think about it.
Okay.
What a silly.
It would be... I think we have a number of other things we need to find out. I think it's be instructive to talk to Mr. Overby about this also.
Yeah, I want to know if it's possible to get any more definite statement from the FAA.
I think it is. We're working on it. There, considering at the present time.
Lisa?
Well, there should be in your folders the letter that Mr. Uters mentioned, the internal letter in the FAA, and the second page of that is the one that gives the hope, the second and third paragraph. In your memorandum, Josh, the quality time, the commission does not go for the action to accept by the state of Alaska. Under this interpretation, state can receive and obtain the benefits of the grant covering the approved project subject to the restraint placed on fair overlands by the commission. The next paragraph, section 28.2 of the authorizing statute, does not preclude the sponsor to suggest its incurring cost in its effort to construct it on the project that approved when the grant agreement thereon was established on due to the The only risk that the sponsor could be taking in proceeding with the job would be our possible inability to defend ourselves in the action that went before the court. In other words, if the federal government lost the suit. So that, I think that's in your folder. The other thing I want to mention, Mr. Chairman, is that I believe that time is of the essence. The Department of Transportation is ready to go for bid. Go to bid on the project now for the coming construction season, and every week that it is delayed, the bidding is delayed, that we are that much further behind the construction of the current construction season. We should have gone to bid by now already in order to get full use of the present of the upcoming construction season.
Well, I recognize that, and I'd like to have the commissioner make some kind of a statement. They got, came in here and off he went. I'd like to ask Commissioner Harris what the department's position is.
Have you called him?
Yeah.
I could tell him when
we have the time, not even back at that.
I don't think we've got any time right now for him. I think the commissioner ought to want to give us some kind of definitive statement on the department's position here.
You want our airport.
And what the effect of the delay. We're talking about, we're gambling with an awful lot of money here that we could use for any number of different purposes.
Steve?
Yeah.
What the, you know, why won't Overby take the same action against the state they've taken against the
I would imagine that he would, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is no state requirement on crosswinds. It would have to be some other element, and of course that's possible, but I think I asked you this at a hearing before, and you are not aware of any...
I've asked the same question of our legal people, and apparently we are simply not as vulnerable. Like they'll say, there's nothing that to challenge from the state's point of view.
No, it's a kind of a constructive condemnation question. And in any event, the state gets to go right ahead with the project and settle those condemnation questions as they go along. They do have eminent domain authority there. And so that wouldn't reach the same question. Okay. Well,
I'd like a question.
Yeah, Clark.
I realize if we didn't get reimbursed, the net result would be still $30 million worth of federal aid, wouldn't it, for other projects or not? Is that the correct way of viewing it? And I don't know if there's that much in terms of airport construction in the rest of the state, but I imagine there is.
Listen,
now in that camp.
Yeah.
So
it would not be possible to apply that full $30 million to other projects because of timing considerations. That's one of the problems. A certain part of that money is discretionary money, which would lapse at the end of the fiscal year. And it simply is not possible, you know, from now until October to bring forward alternate projects and move them through the paper process that you have to go through on a federal grant project, acquire land, do your environmental assessment, that type of thing. So I would guess that perhaps as much as $4 or $5 or $6 million in discretionary funds could not be incorporated into other projects.
But the rest could.
But the rest.
How much?
Somewhere around 5 million.
Bill, what is the status of it? In other words, if you were to get the benefit of this year's construction season, what's the last possible date we'll say that you've got to have an appropriation approved?
We're losing construction season right now. We had hoped to get the job out in January, and that would give the contractor a full crack at the construction season. So,
is there really a construction season in that sense?
Yes. Okay. For this type of work, it's basically a grading job, which cannot reasonably be done during the winter time.
Yeah.
We'd like to have had the contractor out there moving material within another month, and probably looking at least 75 to 90 days from start of advertisement of bids to start of construction. That much time lag in advertising, award of contract, mobilization, the notice proceeding.
Mr. Macon.
Mr. Chairman, I think one way of looking at it from a cost benefit view is that it may cost us $5 million if worse comes to worse and this money never comes to, the money never comes through for this airport, so we have to use state general fund, but then we can apply 25 of that 30 to other projects that we're probably going to undertake, so we'd be $5 million in the hole. But on the other hand, every year we delay, it's probably going to cost us about $5 million in terms of increased costs.
Okay, but so I understood it.
Basically,
if you didn't bid this project as a whole, it would cost a lot more. Is that correct, Bill?
We think it would cost more.
So you got that. Okay. So that hits you in the face. Now, I think we need a better commitment from the FAA than is contained in that memorandum. It was my understanding that there was a commitment from FAA beyond any reasonable doubt that showed that they would come in if they prevailed in a lawsuit, that we could come back in and take over this funding. But I don't see any commitment there. Are they going to come up with one?
I think so.
How long before they do that?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I talked to their attorney and their airport's people yesterday, and I know that they're working on it. Being discussed within the agency.
All right. Well, Clark,
what are your plans, Mr. Chairman, in terms of the next meeting? Are we going to wait to hear Mr. Overby?
Well, I'd like to get some kind of FAA commitment also, but I can tell you, John Overby's got an entirely different. He's coming from whole different place. It's hard to recognize that he and the state are in the same ballpark. So I'm in no position to assess the litigation at all.
I didn't quite for us to decide. My principal concern is with the safety aspect. You can look at it one way, and if you look at it entirely in terms of safety, we should go ahead regardless of what the FAA does, but I understand probably it's better to get their commitment.
How much grading work could you reasonably expect to have done during this season if we just, for instance, appropriated money to international airport funds and some general funds for the grading? Has that been broken down in that sense?
Yes. I think the total grading is something like 7 million cubic yards, and I think if we were to advertise very shortly, it might be possible to move a third to a half of that this season.
How much money we're talking about?
Somewhere around.
Based on this year's construction, it's not 3 years ahead. So that might be a doubt. I don't know whether the numbers have changed, but the bill as it now stands
million, 20 million six. No, here's the committee report. Okay, does that sound correct? 20.6 million?
That's ample.
And that would, okay. I don't know about the members of the committee. I'm not ready to take action on this yet, but I don't abide by whatever the committee wants to do. Russ?
Well, I don't know if we're ready to take action, but I'm ready to take some action fairly soon. I mean, I think,
yeah.
You know, I think Clark's point, you know, from where we're coming from, I think from Anchorage anyway, talking about a fairly dangerous situation, and if you miss it by a week, you know, the plane's going to crash. I mean, it's crazy to wait a year, and I think that the inflation and cost due to the anticipation of the gas line, the inflation is going to be 13-15% again, like it was right before the oil line. You're talking about, you're losing, even if you went piecemeal, you're going to lose more money waiting a year than you'd lose by putting the contract out in pieces.
Okay, on the other hand, this isn't something that just happened overnight either, is it?
I mean, that airport's been there a long time, the same conditions have been there a long time, and all along, you know,
Seven forty-sevens.
They've been making for quite some time, though, Mr. Good.
100,000 landings and one problem.
Well,
and you're talking about a lot of money.
That's right. Okay, I think what we need is something better out of the FAA. Now, will the department lean on those guys and tell them
we are?
Is there anything? Can the governor contact them? I think maybe the governor ought to contact him personally, and perhaps our congressional delegation.
Steve?
Yeah, Ernie?
Why don't we give it 4 or 5 days to see what they can accomplish. We put the heat on. We extract the heat. We're going to get out of here before June anyway.
Well, I would like to get this work started, though. Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we'll adjourn then for the time being on this bill. We don't intend to sit on it, however. The meeting to order. We have with us today members of the Alaska Association of School Administrators and the
chosen spokesperson around. Lynn, are you going to make the presentation here to us?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, I'm Glenn Chowning, the president of the Alaska Association of School Administrators. First of all, I'd like to introduce our officers. Ron Holman, who's president-elect at Superintendent Knoll, and John Antonin, poor John. John Antonin, who's secretary of treasury, Superintendent Kodiak.
Incidentally, for the association's benefit, I'd like to introduce the members of the committee who are here. Some members are working on the subcommittee assignments on the budget. But this is Representative Red Swanson from Nenana, Representative Ernie Haugen from Petersburg, Representative Leo Rode from Homer, Representative Oral Freeman from Ketchikan, and Steve Cooper from Fairbanks. Yes?
So what I'm going to be doing is covering a variety of legislation to begin with that we're concerned about. We had a meeting Sunday and addressed legislation, and I'd like to give you our position on several bills, and then I'll be asking two of the other members to present some testimony on construction and on special education. So the first of all, we support doing away with the majority requirement for runoff elections in REAAs, the 40% runoff requirement. We feel like that the cost of doing that, the problem of getting people to run for the REAA school boards, and just the general problem of having an election makes this really a unfeasible situation requiring the runoff election.
Glenn, excuse me.
Yes.
Would it be all right if the members just sort of butted in and asked some questions as you go along? I think
great.
It might be. Sure. I've got a question there.
Yes.
Who pays for that election? The school district pays for it or the state?
The state pays for it. Okay. Right.
You should know it.
No, just if you have any questions on that state.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
Didn't we do that in the first go around on
the first go around, Red? Yes.
And we can go back to that law and just
right. We didn't require the 40% the majority requirement, and then the last time it was required. And
okay.
There is legislation to do away with that in the REAs, which
we could go back to the first.
Okay, we support the strengthening the requirements for recall petitions of elected officials. We believe that this legislation provides the safeguards necessary to assure that public officials will be given a fair opportunity to defend themselves in the event of recall petitions. We feel that the legislation that has been presented doesn't do away with the opportunity for recall elections, but it allows the official to defend themselves in writing, and that makes it a lot cleaner. Okay, we support allowing up to 180 days accumulated sick leave to be used towards retirement of certificated personnel. We feel that this would cut down on the abuse of sick leave in the schools if certificated people could accumulate this towards retirement. And we wouldn't be faced with the situation of use it or lose it. And I think we do get a lot of abuse of the sick leave, and this would help this situation. Okay. We support the full funding, as stated in the statutes, for community schools. We feel like the legislature passed this legislation, and that the communities expect these funds to be available. We feel that adult education is needed in the communities, and we'd like to see that full funded by statute, community schools. We support the Department of Education's formula for funding bilingual education. As you know, many of the districts had problems with the Office of Civil Rights in the last couple years. There's problems with compliance. The Department of Education has come up with a system for funding bilingual education. We don't know that it's the answer, but we know that we have to have something to comply with the Office of Civil Rights, and we support going along with this for 1 year.
Mr. Swanson.
Yeah. Now, when you say that you support the Department of Education supports the bilingual program, what you're saying then really is that you'd like to split off bilingual, bicultural?
No, no. It's a bilingual, bicultural bill.
Okay.
And it's Senate Bill 951 is their funding bill. 851, you're right. We support that.
Incidentally, Representative Thelma Buckhold of Anchorage, to be more specific, Spinard, who just come in the room.
Okay. All right. We support the allowing a teacher to seek judicial review by a superior court to determine whether due process has been afforded and whether the decision was supported by substantial evidence. This is doing away with the present legislation, which allows them a de novo trial. And we support the legislation for the judicial review to check whether or not they had due process and that substantial evidence was available.
Ms. Buckhold.
To what extent do you support the program of PTPC, professional teachers?
We don't support it. I'm going to speak to that shortly. We support adding 1 year to the process of gaining tenure by certificated personnel. We feel like that the one more year, changing from 2 years, as you know, at the present time, a certificated person at the beginning of their third year acquires tenure. And we support adding one more year to this, making it 3 years before they gain tenure status. We feel this would give us a better opportunity to evaluate and determine the qualifications of teachers and would upgrade the standards of teachers by having one more year. We do not support the requiring approval of the community school committee in hiring personnel. We feel like that this conflicts with the legal authority of the elected school board. We feel like administratively it would be very difficult because of the geography and the communications involved giving the community school committees the hiring authority, and possibly would even be illegal when you have a legally elected school board.
Excuse me, is there a bill in on that, or is that the practice today, or is it?
Well, there is a bill in on that. I don't know what number it is, but there is a bill in on that to allow the community school committees in the villages and the REAAs, I'm just talking about the REAAs, to determine or to hire or to rule on the hiring of all personnel, and we do not support that.
Do you want a clarification in the law?
No, we don't think anything needs to be in the law. There is legislation saying that the community school committees will rule on the hiring of personnel in their villages, so to speak. We're against that.
I don't recall that ever being in the law.
Does anyone know what number that is? It isn't in the law, but there's one being proposed. Yeah, no, it's not in the law. Yeah. Yeah, it's House Bill 793. And going on with community schools, we do not support the idea of mandating community school committees in the REAAs. In the bill that established the REAAs, there was a mandate that each school will have a community school committee. We think that the REAA should be treated as any other school district, as the cities and boroughs are treated, and they are not required to have community school committees. We feel that this should be the option of the elected school board, whether or not they desire these. In most cases, they probably would, but there are some districts that possibly do not need them and wouldn't want community school committees, specifically ADAC, Metlakatla, and Delta Junction, where the community is right there, and you're ending up with three or four school boards to deal with, and the legal board is right there in the same community.
Is that the case now?
The case is, we're supposed to have them in every school or community.
Okay.
Community school committee.
Mr. Swanson?
Yeah, well, in a school committee, I have a pretty much of a feeling here that they do serve a good purpose, and I understand your point of where you have an REAA that doesn't have any other community in the REAA. You are one basic, the town of Delta Junction, Fort Greeley is one unit, but there are a lot of REAAs that have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 units, and I think with the school community committee, it would give a better balance to your school board and give you sometimes a little better direction. You're not plagued with that problem, but I think that some of the communities, it is necessary, at least I feel that way, and that if, probably Mr. Chairman, if we might write into the law regulation an exception under certain conditions, it might alleviate the problem, but I think we'd be doing a disservice here.
No, Red, I would agree with you wholeheartedly. What I'm saying is that that the local school board or the elected school board should have the option, as they do in the cities and boroughs, to decide whether they have. For instance, Kenai has many schools in the Kenai borough, but there's no mandate that they have to have community school committees, and I don't know for sure, but I would assume they probably have something to that extent in each one of their communities. And they would have them anyhow. Tope, for instance, which one I'm familiar with, they're valuable. I'll agree, and I'm sure that you would have them, or Tope would have them. Okay, we do not support community committee substitute for House Bill 489, which is the one dealing with many things and many of the things that we are against as a group. The broadening the scope of bargaining. We believe that the Supreme Court in their decision finally identified what is negotiable, and that this should be economic concerns only, and that all other considerations should be the prerogative of the local elected officials. We believe in local control, and we feel with the broadening the scope of bargaining, we're taking a lot of this out of the hands of the local officials. And that the opening up of working conditions would be just another point to argue with in negotiations. We feel like it needs to be defined more specifically, and it needs to be defined only including economic concerns in negotiations with teachers.
Yes. Yeah. In the bill, there's a clause in there that puts the jurisdiction of definition in the Department of Labor. Do you have any feeling on whether the Department of Labor should define what the conditions are?
Well, we feel strongly they shouldn't. We feel like it shouldn't be in there at all, the working conditions. Of course, with no history, we don't know how that's going to work. But we don't feel like working conditions is just a nebulous term which opens up everything to collective bargaining. And I don't see how the Department of Labor could define it either. I can't define specifically what working conditions are. It couldn't include anything to bargain over. Going along with that, we feel that bargaining is very costly to school districts, and it doesn't contribute to the education of children. We also feel that, we are very strongly opposed to binding arbitration, and we feel that this takes the decision making out of the hands of elected officials and allows a third party who is not responsible to anyone to control the educational resources. And again, we believe in local control, and we feel that the elected officials should be making these decisions. And historically, we feel that salaries are good, that teachers in this case are being paid well in the state, and they would be paid well without collective bargaining, and certainly without binding arbitration.
In the area of binding arbitration, again, I would ask you another question. Do you think that if and when we have binding arbitration, do you think that there should be a standard set as to the man's qualification as an arbitrator? That probably he should not be from somebody outside, and that it should, do you think, really, when you stop to think about it, should he have a set of standards too?
I would think he should, Red. Of course.
We don't have one. You see, we don't have
a standard. Of course, we're completely opposed to binding arbitration.
Suppose you get one. That's my point. Now, if you get one, then wouldn't you want him under a certain set of standards that would deal with Alaska instead of with the set of standards that he would deal with in Oklahoma or Texas?
Oh, I would think we'd have to have some standards. Yes, I agree.
Okay.
We do not believe in giving the teachers the right to strike, which is another part of this committee substitute for House Bill 489. We feel that this would be harmful to the public welfare. And another reason is the fact that we have a law in the state of Alaska requiring 180-day school attendance. And the point being that with teachers striking, they do not lose any money as other groups might. We're still going to have to have school 180 days, so they could strike and still make the same amount of money that they would if they didn't strike. So they're really not losing anything by striking. And we just feel that this is bad for the public welfare to allow teachers to strike. We do not support the raising the teacher's certificate fee to $50. This is the bill that Mrs. Buckle was talking about, to support the Professional Teaching Practices Committee. We are not necessarily opposed to the raising of the fees, but we don't believe that that it should go to PTPC. We don't believe that there's any need for PTPC. That with the requirements of negotiations and the grievance procedures that are available to teachers, they have methods to address their problems, and also the fact that we don't believe that PTPC is doing what it was set up to do, and that is to police the ranks of the Teachers Association. I think they've gotten completely away from that. We understand that there may be a need for something, but the present setup with PTPC is not working in the state of Alaska. We support and we commend the legislature for their prior year funding on the instructional unit, which started 3 or 4 years ago. The legislature, through someone's efforts, agreed that the school districts needed to know the year hence what their funding was going to be. And we certainly commend the legislature and support this. We support a 10% increase in the instructional unit year after next, which would make it $31,900. And the justification for this is that many of the districts in their negotiations with teachers and employees, which amounts to, in some cases, 80 to 85% of their budgets, are negotiating up to and over 10% increases in salaries. And so we feel that this 10% increase is necessary to keep up with what's happening. And we're going to be faced with some things we're afraid of this year that is going to run costs up considerably more, like negotiations with classified personnel in the school districts, like unemployment insurance. Those kinds of things are going to run our costs up considerably more. And that's about all I have.
Do the members of the committee have further questions, Mr. Channing, Is it Mr. or Doctor? I fouled up.
Oh, just Mr. Glenn.
Okay. Are there other persons, Glenn, that have
yes.
For presentations they'd like to make? I've got to go out of town, and I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Freeman, who's the vice chairman of the committee. I'd like to thank you.
We thank you.
We'll continue here.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Daryl Hargraves, who is superintendent of schools at Nome, who is going to speak to the Capitol construction. He and Larry Nyland from the Alaska Rail Belt, Alaska Central, what do you call it? We'll be speaking to that. So,
very well.
Daryl Hargraves.
Would you like to have a big seat at the head of the table there?
Daryl Hargraves, Vice Chairman.
Chairman Benner, and the committee member, Glenn Pine, that's the representative of Park, greetings from Anchorage.
Continue. Vice Chairman Freeman, members, the Alaska Association of School Administrators has been in session in the city for the past few days, and there are, as you have already heard, some very strong interest and concerns on our part in many areas of legislation. There is some legislation, and there are programs already in existence which have tremendous implications for schools, for education, the climate in which children learn, the environment for learning for many years to come. What you have done in recent years, what you're doing this year and in possibly a future session, can determine for a long time this environmental educational climate of the children in their school facilities. The Alaska Association of School Administrators has had, I think, unanimous agreement that there are some basic concepts in this area of school district facilities funding that we would like to present to you. First off, there is a House Bill 681 which establishes a floor at 80% of school district funding. We think that bill has the 80% floor is very good. Quite possibly there are some additional factors and things that should be considered as you look at that bill. We would like to ask that the concept of upfront monies be considered. This state has a wide variety of valuations in local communities. If you go to the various communities, you'll find the bottom is very low assessed evaluation per student, and it can be extremely high in some other places. Therefore, to take care of all concerned, we think that it's very important that you provide some upfront money so that school districts can proceed with capital construction. An example of this might be a small community with low tax evaluation, which couldn't float bonds. They couldn't even keep the interest paid up those first 2 years. They couldn't get the project underway. Possibly they couldn't sell their bonds to begin with without some assurance of upfront monies.
This is in addition to the general obligation bonds that the state may put on for school construction?
You have laws right now which reimburse local organized school districts. We're talking about the local organized school districts. The bond issue, which would be a state bond issue.
We've given those to school districts as well.
Yeah, those will, well, okay. The bond issue will be discussed by another gentleman present. But in the regular construction in the organized areas, municipals and boroughs, we'd like to see the 80% floor, and then we would like to see the upfront monies to make it possible for them to initiate their construction. And then we would like to see another thing which we think is very important, and that is the 80 to 100% sliding scale. We were asked earlier today if we agreed that it should be 100% in some cases. We agree that it's important for local districts to make some contribution. That's no problem. But we think if it's based on the local valuation, that will give a formula, or somehow there could be a formula worked out, where some schools would be 80%, some would be 85, some 90, some 95, and possibly some 98%. Very much like the instructional unit is used in those organized municipalities and boroughs. These two factors, the front-end money, the sliding scale on this, we think should be based on regional and valuation per pupil differences. The differences that are from one region to the next on the pupil valuation. Again, the floor of 80% is important. The sliding scale is important. The upfront monies are important. The association also recognized that there are some, in this state from time to time, some interesting situations that develop. Some from fire and disaster, some from long neglect and perhaps oversight in a particular community, that some community might go for a long period of time overlooked in its school district facilities is a possibility. And so the association would continue to support special legislation to meet the special area problems or unique facilities needs of various communities. In other words, we would support, whether it's bond issue or direct appropriation, whatever the legislature in its wisdom attempted to do to get funding to special projects in individual communities. The one other area that has been brought up as a major concern, and this almost crosses over into some other areas, but it's a concept which is causing us some problems in the field. It's possibly causing you some problems, and it could get to be a greater problem as time goes on. This has to do with the enabling legislation which provides funding in some field or the other, whether it's in community schools, which is an example, enabling legislation which lays out a plan or a path for us to follow, and then a decreased funding the very next year or the year after. The thing that all of you may be familiar with affects in school district facilities is that of a bill which I understand was passed into law, which some school districts set their plans for the future on the basis of this law. This legislation made 100% reimbursement to those districts of their outstanding indebtedness, I believe, prior to 1976. Some of those school districts proceeded because that was in law, in statute. Today, they have, I believe, received 80% actual funding. This is going to cause all of us some problems. It's just a matter of knowing what the law is and then being able to plan on what that law says. That might be true in facilities, it's true in community schools or any other area. Once we set a plan, a course of action, which you say it's going to be that way, the funding sometimes appears to get cut somewhere.
Mr. Howard,
I believe you're talking about House Bill 89 that was is funded up only 80% in the budget this year. Isn't that what you're addressing?
Yes.
It could be.
Isn't that right? Now I'm here at the subcommittee, Chairman. I agree with you. I mean, you planned your budgets on receiving that money, that debt service and principal retirement.
Yes, that's it. The situation that exists is you'll have, because that legislation went through, you perhaps had a municipality or a borough that went out and sold a new bond issue to meet its future needs on the basis that that law existed.
I don't think you have any problems. You straighten out.
You think that'll be straightened out? I might say that I have had occasion to talk to some borough managers.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. The question was, is there an appropriation bill to bring that up to 100%?
It's funded, like, I think some of us have been on finance for several years know that sometimes they short fund revenue sharing and others. And I think Mr. Freeman would agree with me that in every case we brought it back to what the law said. The school in my district had the same problem that you relate to, and I noticed it in the budget, but I'm all homeless that night. Sure, it'll be brought back to 100%.
Mr. Green?
All budgets are predicated on it.
Just mentioned, there are some appropriation bills, there are appropriations, and it has to bring it up to 100%. In addition, of course, we can fund that in the budget bill, which we're dealing with now in our budget area, at 100%. It's just a question of...
Have you in a prior year passed 100% funding for that?
Old House Bill 89 that passed last year.
Each year that has to be funded, just like the school that...
So if you pass it and get the funds there, it can, the districts could depend on it.
They could depend on it if it's in the budget, which is what we're considering. The foundation program, of course, it hasn't been funded at less than 100%, but it could be if the funds, there weren't enough money available. The same thing goes for the program for reimbursing the districts for capital improvements under House Bill 89. The governor submitted the budget to us with less than full funding. And so it's up to us either to accept or reject his decision. And in fact, we'll be working on that in the next couple of days.
Before you continue, I have a couple of other people that I want to introduce. I skipped Mr. Guy, Representative Guy, and Representative Duncan that just came in.
That's all I had on this part of the school district facilities. Mr. Larry Nyland can speak to you about the bonding issue of 72 or whatever.
Just a second. Were there any other questions, Mr. Rhodes?
What you mentioned is upfront money. What percent do you think could be a desirable or feasible amount?
I think that might be very hard to pin down. It might equal the repayment of the bond issue for the first 2 years. If that would be done, that could guarantee the repayment the first and the second year of the life of the bond issue. That would make more likely that a local municipality could sell its bonds if there's assurance of payment that first and second year. The problem you get into, I think, right now is that many of these municipalities, 20% local contribution on that 80% floor is fine for the district that has it. But you have other districts that, without state participation, they're not going to be able to sell bonds with that 20% in there. If they could come up to maybe 7% of local payment, they could handle it.
Mr. Hoggan?
Did you discuss basic need as far as the requirements of what the state will pay for basic need? You understand what I'm saying?
The instructional unit, our basic need of facilities? We did not. We understand full well that regulations sometimes are necessary. Our position on that simply is that perhaps a set of standards or criteria could be established. I think we have a strong feeling that local communities do have the capability of handling their bond monies. If we went to a strict adherence to a set of regulations, in talking to a borough manager, conceivably this could happen. A school district is growing. They know that 4 years from now they're going to need X number of square feet of floor space. It would be very economical for them to put the second floor walls and roof on a building and leave it vacant. This would be a concept in school district facilities construction that might be very sound. But you could establish some regulations that would prohibit that. Say they're overbuilding, when in fact they might pay twice as much for that space 4 years from now because of inflation. It'd be better to go ahead and put the walls up, but I think that the discretion and wisdom of those local municipalities, boroughs, and cities is very good discretion to fall back upon. We'd like to give that as much leeway as we could.
Well, I think there is a feeling, I know what you're saying, and I can pretty much agree with basic construction that what you're saying is right. But I mean, if it overbuilt, and I think we talk about basic needs, we talk about classroom space, and certainly when you're building a new school, you plan some growth into it too. But what if you wanted to build a swimming pool or have a culture center and things like that? This is what I'm...
That's the reason we would feel that things could be overdone and there...
But you would sort of, if you had 20% local control, you could probably control basic needs. That's about it.
Further questions?
If not, thank you very much, sir.
This association would be happy, I think, to work with any group or agency to set up criteria that would speak to that problem that was brought up.
Where is it?
I'd like to speak to the two issues with regard to construction in rural areas. First one is the $72 million bond issue, or the bond issue that's been recommended by the governor at $72 million. As you know, the basic criteria for the projects that are listed in that bond issue are for the construction of rural high schools to meet the consent decree for the Hooch case. The association supports this bill. At the same time, we are concerned that in many cases the local districts in those rural communities have set priorities that are equally high for facilities which are necessary to be replaced, facilities which are not included on this particular bond issue proposal as it now stands. One specific recommendation that we would make as an association is that the appropriation from that bond issue be made on a lump sum basis to districts as opposed to the line item format that is presently used naming school location. The reason for doing that is similar to the issue that Mr. Hargraves has just raised, in that due to a large number of factors, from inflation to the bidding climate to possible changes in the line item amounts before this bill comes out of the legislature, if a district may find themselves in a position where they have several school locations, all of which have been funded, or it turns out due to construction costs that they're able to complete only 70% or 80% of that particular project, whereas a lump sum type of funding would allow that district to go ahead and complete projects in two or three of those locations, leaving one or two of the locations without a project at the present time. I think that concern is that this is a more effective way of spending bond issue monies, in that the startup costs or the overhead costs, whatever you want to call it, for the architect, for administration, for the Department of Transportation, for all of those different things, add to the cost of the construction project. And if you have to do it once to build 80% of the project, then you have to come back 2 years later to hopefully fund the balance of that project, then you end up duplicating a lot of those administration and architect expenses. The other piece of, do you have any questions on that bond issue?
Is that the governor's bond bill?
Yes.
$72,200,000?
Right. Senate Bill 485 speaks to...
Yeah, I'd like to, in your recommendations under the Molly Hooch case or direction, in the districts, does the district regional education attendance area, the school board, do they make the recommendations on where the high schools are to be built? And does it go through that regional school board or that regional educational attendance area school board to the Department of Education and then to the governor's office?
In this last, the recommendation that the governor made.
$1 million. Where did that come from?
Correct. The Department of Education asked for input from each of the local districts. I believe this September 6th was the date that they gave us to submit our priorities to the Department of Education. And they asked for some specific details in terms of a 6-year construction plan, in terms of the amount of money that would be required, and then the priority that the district assigned to the projects that they had listed in their plans. And as I had indicated at the beginning of my comments, the Department of Education used the criteria pretty much of building rural high schools that would comply with the consent decree for the Hooch case as their priority ranking in going to the governor. So in some cases, districts had high priority items that were not included in the Department of Education's recommendation to the governor because the Department of Education used a different criteria than did the local school district.
I might do one more question just to pinpoint a recommendation. Give us a mythical school that's within on a established highway, state highway system, and has a potential high school students of 10 students within 25 miles, anywhere from 10 to 50 miles or 40 miles, I should say, maybe a little closer than that, 30 miles. The request to build a high school in an area like that versus the possibility of putting their youngsters on a school bus and go to a total, completely modern high school. What kind of a standard would be fit to a thing like that?
I don't know how Department of Education would evaluate that type of a situation. Presumably, what the Department of Education did was that they took the Hooch case consent decree and put it into regulation in a format that covered some additional locations other than the specific locations that were named in the Hooch case. And under that type of, under the regulation that they put into effect, virtually every school, every location in the state that currently has an elementary school could ask the Department of Education for a high school program. And so on that basis, I presume that the Department of Education would make the kind of situation that you're talking about a high priority concern, because if that community had requested a high school, Department of Education would have made that a high priority to give them a high school under the regulations that they had developed.
I pointed this out, Mr. Chairman, because there is a situation where we have probably one of the best high schools of anywhere. It's totally and completely. In fact, it was built under for Northwest Schools criteria, and it's exceptionally fine school, and within just a few short miles on an established highway. And we do, there is a school bus that runs those. They're going to build a Molly Hooch High School in that small community where there might be from 6 to 7 youngsters go to that school. Dollar-wise, and it doesn't sound sensible to me when we're basically educating youngsters. Now, if there was no method of transportation, I could understand it, but I can't understand things like that.
Chairman.
Mr. Gunn.
You've indicated that the REA's local boards and the Department of Education used different kinds of criteria for their determination as to where a high school would be built. Do you mean that the Department of Education's criteria would essentially supersede those of REAs?
Well, in terms of the governor's recommendation, that's apparently what's happened, in that the governor's recommendation includes all of those priorities, or I'm speaking generally, I think it includes just about all of those areas that the Department of Education gave a number one priority to. And there are situations where the number one priority of the district was not included in the governor's recommendation for that bill.
Where was that?
Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, where was that at?
What particular districts?
Yeah.
I think Southwest Region had one at Togiak that wasn't included. Iditarod had one at Anvik that was not included.
Okay.
I don't know all of them specifically, that's just in looking through the list that I saw.
Further questions for me? Further testimony? Mr. Swanson?
Back when we started the construction programs and bond programs, we authorized the state to, we created a revolving loan fund where a front-end money type thing could be used for planning, design, ahead of a bond issue, so we save a year. I'm getting a feedback that that revolving fund hasn't turned into anything but a beautiful place for the architects to go and rip us off. I'll give it to you in plain English, and I would hope that this board and the people gathered in this room would sit down and do some real hard and fast thinking about getting that money where it's supposed to go instead of using it for fly trips all over from hell to breakfast, and you sit down and write some good solid recommendations on the use of those monies and that pre-planning money, and see that maybe probably you could recommend to us that that they eliminate 6 or 7 different departments that's bleeding that fund, and also our bond funds.
I would comment on that, that the there has been some disagreement as to the purpose over which those planning funds could be used for. Department of Administration had originally held that those could be used only for project design, which would mean that the architect would actually have to get in and do start to develop the schematics and the design for the particular building. That gave quite a few of our local districts some difficulty in that prior to that project design phase, project planning phase, there needs to be some planning done in terms of programs, and the Department of Administration was unwilling to fund any work in the area of program planning where time would be spent with the local communities in terms of deciding the kinds of needs that they had and what types of facilities would best meet those needs.
Don't forget the recommendation of the various departments that are bleeding off our school construction funds.
With regard to Senate Bill 485, which deals with the relationship between rural schools and the Department of Transportation, to, I guess, reiterate a comment made earlier by Mr. Towning, one of the things that I think that the association is working toward is some type of fair or equal treatment for city and rural school districts. Presently, a regional education association rural school district can apply to the Department of Transportation for